The main target of the mass murder in El Paso, Texas at the weekend was America's growing Hispanic community. In a 2,000-word-plus manifesto, the shooter, Patrick Crucius, referred to the so-called Hispanic invasion of Texas. Now, President Donald Trump denounced the massacre and the white supremacy behind it, yes, but not before his critics, including the former Vice President Joe Biden, blamed Trump's own comments about immigrants for inflaming hatred. Lawrence Pintak is a former CBS Middle East correspondent. In his new book, America and Islam, he looks at America's relationship with the Muslim world, including the Trump administration's risky flirtation with Saudi Arabia. In this wide-ranging interview, Lawrence began by discussing the weekend's mass shooting.
Well, needless to say, we've been hearing about the threat of invasions for the last 3 or 4 years, haven't we? From the campaign, the Republican primary campaign, when it was Islam that first and foremost was being targeted. Islam hates us, in quotes, right? We also heard about all those nasty Mexicans coming across the border with drugs and rapists, etc. So this is a theme that we have sadly been hearing very volubly for the last few years, but we've been hearing it for a long time before that as well.
Yeah. I mean, Mexicans were the first targets of Donald Trump's speech when he came down that golden escalator in New York to announce his candidacy for the presidency in mid-2015. How soon did he begin to talk about Muslims in addition to Mexicans?
Oh, very, very quickly. He was talking about Muslims early on in the primary. There was the infamous interview with CNN and then a second one with NBC, both of which he talked about the fact that, quote, Islam hates us, creating this monolithic enemy against which we will stand. That has been an undercurrent of his campaign from very early on.
But there was also another comment that you refer to in the book that seemed to resonate, where he spoke about Barack Obama and the way that Obama was responding to the rise of the Islamic State terrorist group. And he said something like, look, there's something going on there. What was he implying?
First of all, you have to remember that he was one of those who implied that Obama was actually not born in the U.S. and was not a Christian. He was a Muslim. And he did that long before he ever declared for the presidency. That specifically, that theme of there's something going on and him implying that Obama was either an idiot or was in cahoots with terrorists, that's a theme that we heard again all through the campaign. This innuendo, there's something going on. What happened over there? What's going on? It was about Muslims, but it was about other minorities, and it was about, generically, his enemies. It meant that he didn't have to make an accusation. He knows that he's speaking to a subset of followers, his base, who are conspiratorially minded. So all you have to do is plant that idea that there's something going on. What's going on with that guy? What's going on with that group? And it goes from there.
To be fair, though, Lawrence, Donald Trump is in no way the inventor of this invective about Muslims, though, is he? This predates Donald Trump by decades.
This goes way back in our history. They accused Barack Obama of being a Muslim, but Thomas Jefferson was accused of being a secret Muslim.
Now, you say from the very start of your book, in fact, I think it's probably the very first sentence, that Donald Trump's stoking of fears about Islam won him enough votes to become president. But was it really the rhetoric about Islam that actually won Donald Trump those hollowed out old industrial heartlands of Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan, where there's a very big Muslim community? Was it really anti-Islamic rhetoric that pushed him into the presidency?
Well, I think it was a big piece of it. The tragedy over the weekend was not aimed at Muslims. It was aimed at Mexicans / Latin Americans. But this is all this moving morass of xenophobic feelings. Now, there are many whites who feel like they're under siege economically, et cetera, and were ignored by Democrats, Republicans, et cetera, in the past, and by we in the media. But they have certainly been entranced by this xenophobic message. But the perception that we had about who they are and you know, they're all wearing tinfoil hats is absolutely not true. As we saw with the numbers in the election, there are many, many middle class, but primarily whites, who see this demographic shift in the U.S. as a great threat, because by 2050, the U.S. will be a non-white nation. And that has a subset of people very frightened.
It does cut across all sorts of socioeconomic groups as well. One of the things that I must say quite shocked me when I read accounts of the manifesto of Patrick Crucius, who's the 21-year-old shooter down in El Paso, who's now murdered 22 people, was the relative sophistication of his political analysis. As frightening as it was, this guy seemed to be very well informed about immigration trends in the United States, about the way that the Democrats were increasingly relying on the Hispanic base. We're talking here about quite a well-educated group of people who share these paranoia.
Absolutely. I think I recount in the book, I had an experience during the primary where I was in the Middle East, and I flew back from Dubai on a direct flight from Dubai to Seattle and landed at 8 o'clock that morning. And at 8 o'clock that night, I was at a Trump rally. And it was the first Trump rally I had covered. And obviously the cognitive dissonance of having been in Pakistan and then the Arab world and then being at a Trump rally. And true to form, he began attacking Syrian refugees, et cetera. But the takeaway was outside talking to the people in line to go in. These were middle class kind of folks, well-spoken, intelligent. But when you asked them, where do you get your news? I expected them to say Fox. Oh, no, no, no. They would get it from Breitbart or these other fringe websites. And that's an echo chamber that reinforces these conspiratorial and paranoid tendencies.
And one of the examples of the sense of conspiracy has been this push, again, that predates Donald Trump, really in existence since 9/11, against Sharia law. This has even crept into state legislatures. How's that?
The difference between then and now is that then, and I'm just talking a couple of years ago, you had this fringe, I mean, way out on the fringe, these people who were shouting and screaming about the threat of Sharia law in the U.S., which is, you know, a complete non-starter. It's ridiculous. But it was an industry. These people moved through state legislatures kind of under the radar and convinced state legislators to vote to enact these rules, these laws. And so I forget what the number is at the moment, something like 20, 25 American legislatures or states have laws in place that ban Sharia law. But again, the difference is that those people, those fringe people, are now in the government. I mean, they included people like Trump's first national security advisor, General Flynn, who obviously resigned in disgrace, etc. But all of these fringe people, the Islamophobia industry, it's been called, there's a report called Fear Incorporated about them, they suddenly ended up moving from the fringe into the heart of American politics and power.
It's the Religion and Ethics Report here on RN and on your pod. And I'm speaking today with Lawrence Pintack. Lawrence is the author of America and Islam, Soundbite, Suicide Bombs and the Road to Donald Trump. And Lawrence was also a former CBS correspondent in the Middle East. Lawrence, let's turn now to foreign policy. Donald Trump seems to be very contradictory in his attitudes here to Islam. On the one hand, you say he's waging war against Islam in America, yet he's clearly taken sides in that great contest in the Muslim world. What has he done there?
Obviously, it is the ultimate irony. A, this idea that Islam, a monolithic thing, hates us, so suddenly we're on the side of one part of Islam against the other side, the Sunnis and Saudis against the Iranians and Shia. And likewise, all during the campaign, the Saudis were portrayed as the devil incarnate. They were the supporters of ISIS, the creators of Al-Qaeda. And he gets into office, and what's the first thing he does? His first overseas trip is to Saudi Arabia. Well, There are those who would argue it's because of his personal business interest, but certainly on the record, he said that he was there because they had promised him tens of millions of dollars or billions of dollars in arms deals. And, of course, they stand against Iran, and that is one of his pet peeves, is Iran. So our foreign policy has been thrown into disarray on multiple levels. A, purely siding with Saudi against Iran. And then, of course, the Saudis turned weeks later on the Qataris, and suddenly we are at odds with Qatar, where the largest U.S. military base is.
Yeah.
So none of this makes any sense.
Well, Donald Trump presents his case against Iran as somehow geostrategic, you know, that Iran wants nuclear weapons to threaten its neighbors, to threaten the U.S.'s most loyal ally in the region, Israel. But do you think there is something else going on with Trump and his attitude to Iran?
Well, I think it's the old autocrats' trick of create the foreign enemy, the external enemy, to distract people from the internal issues. And he early on decided that Iran was something that would resonate with his base, that Barack Obama caved to the Iranians and I'm going to fix the whole thing. And so that resonated with his base and he stayed with it. You know, much like, you know, I'm sure you've read the stories about the wall, the idea that somebody said, as he was trying to figure out his messaging, et cetera, well, why don't we build a wall? And well, yeah, that's simple, clean, straightforward, good soundbite. So yeah, we'll go with that. And now that has become his fixation, as Iran has.
I wonder though, Lawrence, if there's something in the American psyche about Iran that goes back to the hostage crisis in 1979 and 1980, this sort of enduring wound there.
There's an element to that. Certainly the first, quote, Islamic terrorism the U.S. faced was from Iran. And I was in Beirut in the 80s when Hezbollah rose and carried out the suicide bombings. So sure, there's that residual remnant of memory. But by the same token, a lot more fresh is 9/11 and Afghanistan and Iraq and all that has come with that. Perhaps it's not as simple as blaming the Iranian government for backing terror when you don't have the smoking gun with the Saudis. But he made a pretty good case for there being a smoking gun during his campaign and then flipped around.
Lawrence, this is the great contradiction, because 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. A former courier for Al-Qaeda has made it very plain in legal testimony that the Saudi government or people associated on the fringes of the Saudi government were involved in funding Al-Qaeda and the terrorist operation. There's a lawsuit by the families of the 9/11 victims against the Saudi government. And yet, in every possible way, Donald Trump gets closer to the Saudis and to their supposedly reforming prince.
Well, and he remains the reforming prince, even though people are being massacred in Yemen, even though Jamal Khashoggi was slaughtered and cut into little pieces in the embassy in Istanbul. And still, Trump calls him a reformer and, you know, a voice of reason, et cetera, et cetera. So, no, there's no logic.
Do the people around Trump, if not Trump himself, though, acknowledge the role of Saudi Arabia as the exporter of this, certainly at its minimum, very austere and authoritarian form of Islam, but at its worst, a violent form of Islamism? Do they acknowledge that? Do they understand that?
They acknowledge it, but they say that that's no longer the case. That's the key piece of this relationship now. The idea that, yes, the Saudis were the bad guys in exporting Wahhabism, in supporting Al-Qaeda, in supporting ISIS, but they've turned around. And MBS is the reformer. He's sidelining all the extremists. He's changing his whole approach to the spread of Islam. And he's the good guy now, and he has the white hat.
There's a wonderful story in your book. There are many wonderful stories, but I was particularly taken by the account of MBS's father, Mohammed bin Salman's father, the king, making a visit to Indonesia. He has 1,500 people in tow, but most surprisingly, he takes his own gold-plated escalators.
Don't we all? Yes, and it's an example of the massive influence that the Saudis have across the Muslim world. Recently, they were building something like 500 new mosques in Bangladesh, for example. They just pour money into these countries, and they have very effectively changed the nature of Islam in these places. I lived in Indonesia for a number of years, and Indonesian Islam was a very, shall I say, gentle approach to the religion. No one was trying to convert you. No one was trying to order you to do this, that, or the other thing. And it had a lot of local animist belief systems merged into Islam. Now, thanks to Saudi money, there are huge organizations in Indonesia that are very fundamentalist and are operating both in terms of the religion and in terms of politics. And you see it very visually in terms of many, many women now wearing hijab where they didn't before.
Well, I think we've discovered the basis of Donald Trump's affinity with the Saudis, and that is they both have gold escalators.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, they had his picture projected on the side of buildings, et cetera, when he arrived. So they played to him. They know how to manipulate him.
Look, just finally, Lawrence, you make the argument that the solution to the tensions that have been extant in America over Islam for decades, for centuries, you say, is the Americanization of Islam. Now, what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that as a result of all of the negative rhetoric of the election, the campaign, and then the years since the election, American Muslims have been energized. So we saw in the 2018 midterm elections, 166, by our count, American Muslims run for office. Many more are gearing up to run again. And despite the demonization of Ilhan Omar, the congresswoman from Minnesota who wears hijab, Somali refugee, many others want to enter the fray. And then on the religious side, what is happening is that at home, in the old country, as it were, people adhered very closely to whatever their sect was, whether it was Sunni or Shia or Ahmadi or some subset thereof. Here in the U.S., it's blending together. Here in the U.S., you have many, as I'm sure in Australia, common mosques with people of all spectrums of Islam. And then the most fundamental thing or important thing is that the generations of foreign imams who came here to run a mosque from Egypt, from Saudi Arabia, from Pakistan, they are now giving way to a whole new generation of American imams, U.S.-born Muslims.
And I'll bet many of those new American imams speak with an Alabama or a Mississippi or a Texas twang too.
You better believe it.
That's Lawrence Pintak, the former CBS Middle East correspondent and author of America and Islam, Soundbite, Suicide Bombs, and the Road to Donald Trump.